But there are very specific questions the community wants to know.
What's a secret you never told anyone in the crypto community?
You gotta have a secret.
And the doctors basically said, look, there's an 80% chance that you have cancer in your prostate. My receptionist calls me, there's a liquidator here and he's yet to liquidate the business.
Huh?
What? You only have one life, and in that one life, you have 28,800 days. The sooner you can start making that impact, the better. I lost over 50% of my wealth, 100 million plus. I really thought a lot of people would leave, and I think a lot of people came very close to leaving.
The reason why I do 7 shows is because you push it.
There was a period in my life where I was like, I just need to prove to myself that I'm a sex god. Switch on a helicopter, and I kid you not, I landed this fucking helicopter in the parking lot of the grocery store. And like, there's thousands of people just watching this, but I mean, like, which crypto personality do you think is completely fake? This is, you're going to get me in trouble with a lot of my friends.
So what do you think this is about?
I don't know. I mean, judging from what you have done in my DMs, I guess what you've asked is you've asked the community to ask me a whole lot of questions, right? And stuff that I ordinarily wouldn't discuss on the show. And you kind of want me to lay it all out here. That's because I've got a lot of like DMs. You were in my Twitter DM. So yeah, I'm expecting you to hit me with a whole lot of questions here. Questions of things that I don't really discuss on the show. So I kind of imagine that you're not going to ask me about my favorite tokens and stuff like that. And then you're going to get much, much deeper questions. Yeah. And I'm excited. I see you got the jelly beans.
Yeah, that's for it. We're going to do 23 episodes.
I want those for my kids this weekend. And the whole weekend, I've got tortured by having to eat wet dog, stinky. I played that the whole weekend, bro.
That's good. That's good that you primed them. You have no idea what's coming.
So this about.
You have no idea. Yeah, that's a bucket I brought you. But this is for the next episode. I want to keep this. This episode is all about seriousness. Okay, so we deep dive. I didn't want to go through, you know, the history and your story because we heard it already. But there are very specific questions the community wants to know. We're going to go deep. And
yeah, okay, it's good. Good. I'm in your hands.
What's one book or movie that has profoundly influenced your worldview?
So I can't watch movies. I've got terrible ADD. Cannot watch a movie. Never, ever, ever been able to watch a movie. I've probably watched 1,000 movies.
You read a book.
Ask me anything that's happened in a movie, I can't tell you. Do I read books? Yes, I do read a lot of books, but I don't read. I listen. And I listen on 2-speed. And if the program allows, then I go on to 2.5-speed. I'm going to open my Audible just so that you can see the kind of things that I have been listening to. So the last one that I read is Dan Ariely's book.
What's your favorite book? That what you say, you have to read that book.
I'm not into books like that. So I read actually a lot rightly, I listen to a lot of books. So I'm halfway through The Upside of Irrationality, which is Dan Ariely. He's a behavioral economist.
Oh, so you're not really looking at crypto stuff and finance, but specifically.
I'll read you a list of the stuff that I've read recently. So I'm halfway through The Upside of Irrationality, and it's probably the third book of Dan Ariely that I've read because I'm obsessed with how the mind thinks and how to get people to do things without actually getting into do things. So Dan Ariely, he's my favorite behavioral economist. I read Patrick Bet-David's book, Choose Your Enemies Wisely. I found it's a great book. I just found that I think I've had those experiences. I think the book was targeted at people that hadn't had those experiences. So The Infinite Machine, I actually read the Ethereum book, The Infinite Machine, that I first written by Camilla Russo. That's because I know all the players. Then I read Rise, which is the story of Siya Kolisi, the South African rugby captain.
So it's all around the Oracle's world.
Yeah. Then Elon Musk's book by Walter Isaacson. I read that. Then I read a book called The Billion Dollar Whale.
Billion Dollar Whale. We need, I thought you were going to say Billion Dollar Hustle.
Yes. Never Split the Difference, which is a negotiation book from Harvard, which I just read because one of my lecturers actually wrote it. So I just wanted to just understand him better. These are the books that I read. Again, I don't do anything where I don't learn anything. So like I consume 8 hours of content every single day. And I don't spend any time consuming any content where I'm not going to learn anything. It's crazy. I know. I never just let my mind rest. I listen to everything on 2-speed. The reason why I listen to everything on 2-speed is because it forces me to zone in. Because on 1-speed, your mind can go to a million different places. On 2-speed, you actually have to listen in, and that keeps you concentrated. So everything I listen to is on 2-speed and
Chrome, there's a Chrome extension that allows you to go up to like 5, 6, 7.
Yeah.
Do the same. Okay, next question. If you could give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be?
Buy Bitcoin.
Okay, other than buy Bitcoin?
Well, no, I think couple of things that I think I, if I could go back, I would. The first thing is, one, don't be afraid to fuck up. Like, I think a lot of people are scared of failure. I actually celebrate failure. I love failure. Because I think if you failed on something, it means that you've tried to do something that no one else has done before. And when you try and do something that no one else has done before, 9 out of 10 times you're going to do it wrong and you're going to fail. Society has a way of looking at failure as a bad thing. Now, we conditioned, if you failed, it's bad. Like a failed entrepreneur, people look at you like, oh, you started out. What they don't look at is they don't say, hold on, he tried to do something that nobody else could ever do. He failed. And if I celebrate him, he will try again. And if I knock him down, he won't try again. So number one, celebrate your failures. Okay, not stupidly. Celebrate the first time you failed at something. Yeah. If you failed the same thing more than once because of the same
belief. Yeah, reevaluate.
That's a problem. So that's the first thing. Second thing is so obviously take as many lessons as you can from as many other people. But if you overanalyze and you take a lot of lessons from a lot of other people, chances are you won't start doing something. Like when I started YouTube streaming, there were 1,000 reasons why I shouldn't have done it. And I still didn't listen to people. I just did it. And, you know, here we are today. So to me, don't be afraid to fail because that means you're actually taking risks. Don't get paralyzed by analysis paralysis. Don't get that. Usually the answers you'll work out through the journey, right? So like usually you'll set out on a journey. Don't try and answer too many questions. Just go. Just jump. Look, I'm not saying my approach is the only approach. Why? Because I have a very unique approach. My approach is like when I interview people, I spend 15 minutes in the interview. If I get a good vibe, I say to them, come, run on the field. Come join us. And then I know within the first month of whether they join us, whether they're the right person or not the right person.
Yeah.
Now, some people want to gather all the information at the start. And so my brother, for example, my brother will do 8 hours of interviews before he hires someone. I'll do 8 minutes. Get a good gut feel because I think I have experience in dealing with people and then put the people in the field and then let them either succeed or fail in the first month. So that's that. And then probably the last one is you only have one life. And in that one life, you have 18,000, you have 28,800 days. So like, if you think about, you have 28,000, the average human has 28,800 days of a life, 90 years plus minus. First 10 years, last 10 years, we can remove. Like we can say that first 10 years, formative years, last 10 years, you know, I wish that you're strong, but you probably won't be.
I mean, tag is coming.
So which means that you have 18,800 days. Now, how these 18,800 days work is the first 18,800 go like this, and then the first 9,400 go like this, and the next 9,400 go like that. So the sooner, I think when you bring it down to the fact that you've only got 18,800 days on this in this earth to actually make an impact, the sooner you can start making that impact, the better. So that means that if you're in a long-term job, chances are jump, and you have a plan to go into entrepreneurship, then jump out early. Why? Because you remember your years go like this. You know, like I think probably if you look at the Jake Paul Mike Tyson fight, it probably summarizes the world beautifully, where it's like, you know, you have Mike Tyson who has all the experience in the world, probably had 100 times the number of fights that Jake Paul's had. He managed to get himself into fitness, but couldn't complete the thing. So, you know, that's in the last part of your 18,800 days. Now, I still think that Mike Tyson's somewhere in those 18,800 days. But I think that when you narrow it down to 18,800 days, that means that every minute is important. So quit your job as quickly as you possibly can. If you want to be an entrepreneur, get into the industry that you want to be in as early as you possibly can. Because every day that you're not, you're actually wasting a day, right? You're wasting a day. Now, when you're young, you don't believe that those days are ever going to end. So it's cool for you to waste a day. But then you get to a point where you go, fuck, I wasted so much time on garbage. And that's the other thing is like, be selective with who you spend your time with and who you spend your efforts with. And I mean, it's like work colleagues, companies, sponsors, suppliers. Be selective about where you spend the majority of your time because, again, you've got 18,800 days. Let's say that you can push X amount of kilowatts per day. The amount of energy that you can expend, that you spend on a bad sponsor versus a good sponsor, or a bad staff member versus a good staff member, or a bad partnership versus a good partnership, is super important. So that, again, when you break it down into 18,800 days, and then you break it down into variables per day. So you say number of kilowatts that you can push as a human per day, number of minutes that you can have in a meeting, etc. Then something you start. So like, that's why I feel so disrespected when people come into meetings with me where they're not prepared. It's like, I've got 18,800 days. I've given you 10 minutes of those 18,800 days, and you've arrived here unprepared.
Perspective, eh?
It's like, why? I'm on the way down now. Like, I've gone over the top. I'm now on the way down, and like, I think it's disrespectful that people arrive unprepared. Also, as you probably noticed, I won't waste time on meetings where I don't think there's going to
be anything. You don't waste time on anything.
Like, why?
Anything?
Well, why? Because I want to, like, I have 18,000, I have less than 9,900 days left, because I'm, you know, the first 50 years and then the next 50 years, I'm probably at the top. I'm not at the top, because I'm exactly halfway. Like, I don't want to be wasting my valuable time on people, on matters, on, you know. That's also like, people said to me, you know, why didn't you sue this one? Or why didn't you sue that one? You know, like, there's a lot of people that, you know, maybe you've been around me, and I don't want to mention names, but I probably should have taken legal action against a lot of people. Why didn't I do it? Because I've got 18,800 days, and I've 9,900 of those are finished, which means that I now need to maximize the amount of time. Do I want to be spending time talking to a lawyer? And even though I know what's right and what's wrong, do I want to spend time talking to a lawyer? I don't. And so that's the perspective that I have. So start early. Don't be afraid to take risks, and be selective about who and how you spend your time with. And that's the most important thing.
You have to be shorter. I want to get all these questions answered. If you could go back to the day you started Benter and make one change, what would it be?
I think we did it so perfectly. Like, we didn't start with the objective of money. We started with the objective of changing people's lives. I had a great co-founder. I mean, maybe I would have built infrastructure faster, but that's it. Like, possibly I would have built infrastructure faster.
Infrastructure meaning team? To scale the team up?
Well, I would have probably had more self-belief that this was going to become a business, because in the beginning, it wasn't supposed to be a business. Mm. So otherwise, yeah, I mean, look, that's it. I think we've executed on Banter. Bro, Banter is a three-year-old business.
Yeah. I remember, for me, it's crazy, because when I came last year, August, it was nowhere near where it is now. And it just happened like
it's
this.
It's a three-year-old business. I've done it right, or we've done it right. And I think the reason why we've done it right is because I have experience. It's not my first rodeo. My last company was my training ground for 17 years, building a business with 1,550 people, 70 offices. That's hard, building a business. I learned a lot of lessons. This time it's easy, bro. This time it's like, oh, that's the answer. Oh, that's the answer. Oh, that's the answer. So yeah, this time it's easy.
How do you define leadership, and how have you embodied it at Benter?
So I'm a big stickler for leadership. So what is leadership? Leadership is effectively, without any rules in place, or with as few rules as possible in place, to get people to do what you need them to do, right? So what does that mean? It means that people must naturally want to follow the leader. So what is it about leaders that people actually want to follow? The first thing is they got to feel safe. So what is safety? Safety means that I know that you're leading me to the right place. So people count on leaders to say, I know that you're leading me to the good end goal. So I think, for one, thinking and having a good end goal in mind. Two is walking the talk. So I think, you know, with me at Banter, like, you all know where you need to get to. The second thing is my communication is, I mean, we have a morning call every morning, maybe every second morning. We have a monthly meeting, which is completely transparent. People actually criticize that. How can you share so many numbers? Because I want people to feel safe. And I want people to know that this is a company of honesty and transparency. So taking people to the right place, being communicative and transparent at every point along the way, so people can fact check you, and then leading from the front, which is making sure that you don't tell people that you can do a daily show. You do a daily show and you show back. And I did 7 shows last week. 7 days, 7 shows. Yep. Why? I mean, on the one hand, I enjoy streaming, but on the other hand, just to set an example, in a bull market, we we've got to walk the talk. If I'm doing 7 shows and I'm probably the most established, probably say wealthiest guy in the company, right? If I'm doing 7 shows, then what excuse have you got to do 4 shows? You don't have excuse. So lead by example, be extremely communicative and take people to the right place. Make people feel comfortable that if they stick around you.
Yeah.
And then I think leadership has to meet management somewhere. If you think about it, like, you know, leadership will get you to a certain point, and then at some point you also got to put in 1 or 2 rules in place. Good leadership is having very few rules. So if you need to have a lot of rules in place in a company, then that means there's probably not good leadership. If you have very few rules, then yeah. A leader's job is traditionally one fold, but it's actually a little bit more than that. So what is a leader's role? A leader's role is to set the culture of the organization. Okay, what does the culture of an organization mean? It means that in the absence of the leader, the troops will do exactly what the leader would do. Okay, so if you're a leader and you don't arrive at, and you are on vacation and your staff arrive at the office an hour later, then your staff aren't doing what they're supposed to do in the absence of a leader, which means you have a bad company culture in your company. If you send your team into a negotiation and they execute as you would have executed, then you have good leadership in organization. So a leader's only role is to set the culture in the organization, because otherwise the leader is always managing by rules. Okay, we don't want to manage by rules. We want to manage by culture. Problem with rules is that rules only manage certain situations, right, that you've been in. The minute that you're in a situation that you haven't been in, there's no rules. So you have to count on how people in your organization are thinking, and that is what the culture is. So what's the leader's role? The leader's role is to set the culture of the organization and to define the culture of the organization. He does that by leading by example and by setting as few rules as possible to actually achieve his objective. So if you think about Banta, there's almost no rules in Banta, but there are certain rules that are exceptionally important. Example, at 9:15, we're all at the office. And if you're not at the office and it's 9:20, you're out of the company. Why? Because we have to respect each other. Because if I'm going to be there at 9:15, you've got to be there at 9:15, because that's mutual respect. Same thing with meetings. We have certain meetings, you're not allowed to miss those meetings. And when you have those meetings, you put a camera on and you're not driving and you're not at a strip club or whatever people do on other meetings. Why? Because that shows that you respect the business, right? And the minute that somebody doesn't respect the business, they should be out of the business. If someone believes that it's okay to arrive at a management meeting or a morning meeting 5 minutes, they should be out of the business. So you know the rules of Banta. The first time you get fined, $500. The second time you get fined, $10,000. And the third time you're out, then you can't come back.
But it is what it is. Actually, the reason why I do 7 shows is because you push it. Like, that's literally the reason.
So the leader's role is to set the culture of the organization. The culture is defined as how the troops would react in the leader's absence. The test for a leader is to go on vacation and shut down his laptop and see what his troops are doing. I'll be honest with you, like, we used to have a problem at Banta where whenever I was on vacation, whenever I was traveling in Singapore or wherever, and I was in a different time zone, the company used to arrive at the office at 10 o'clock. Until one day I got the camera footage without any warning. I basically looked at the people that arrived after 9:15 and I fired them. And that was the last time that it ever happened in the company. Okay, and that's just to tell you, like, don't mess with the culture on this organization.
But I see it. It sounds brutal. I just see people watching this like, holy shit. But it is what it is. But on the other side, it's also good. What is your biggest regret in life? In life. That means not in business, not in crypto. In life.
Maybe not learning more languages. I should have learned more languages.
Do you see that?
I should have learned more languages. Why? Because languages are culture. So it's a language, not a language. A language is culture. When I learn your language, I'm indirectly learning your culture. And I love understanding what makes Hungarians think different from South Africans or Israelis or whatever else, right? Or for example, Asians. Maybe like you're in a meeting with an Asian. There's always that like, I don't get you, you don't get me feeling. So even small things like Asian breakfast, bro. You. Okay, versus Suku. It's different. But why? There's a cultural difference, right? So you have to understand, and language is a way. So wine is not learning enough languages. I only know English, Afrikaans, which is a local language, and I know Hebrew. I should have learned more languages. I've tried to learn Zulu, which is the local language here. I'm trying to learn Spanish, but it's very hard to learn Spanish in an environment where there's no Spaniards. So I probably should have learned more languages. That's one of the regrets that I have. Yeah.
What is the biggest accomplishment of your life and why?
I mean, obviously having kids. So that's the prize. Having kids is the prize. Like, all nothing else matters.
Why?
Because I was a bachelor for 40 years. I did everything that you could do at a bachelor. You've heard some of the stories. I had a helicopter, I did everything that you can do. I mean, I remember when I told you some of the stories, you said to me, these are like Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, it is.
I lived that lifestyle, bro. I was.
You'll have to do that podcast as well.
I was half rich. I was half good looking. And I was single. And I was 35. And that's a very, very, very dangerous combination.
Did you think you were late to having kids?
I mean, my mother convinced me that if I don't get married and have kids by the time I'm 40, I'm never going to have kids. I think that I lived an amazing, amazing, amazing life without responsibilities while my 27-year-old friends had got married. They didn't have the same opportunities that I had. And I'll tell you what I mean. When you get married and you have kids, from that moment on, every decision that you make is actually about your kids and it's no longer about you. Okay? And so that means that your whole worldview changes. So things like, for example, should I go out tonight? Shouldn't I go out tonight? Should I start a business? Shouldn't I start a business? Everything now becomes around the kids.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. But the thing is, I got the luxury of being able to make decisions that were more about my future, which were like, should I start a new business or shouldn't I? If I had kids, probably the answer would have been no. If I didn't have kids. So, I mean, there is an advantage of starting late. The disadvantage is that kids require a lot of energy. And I've got 4 kids and, I'm much older now and they require a lot of fucking energy. So, there's trade-offs. I think I did it the right way. And also, I think for my personality, I think if I would have got married earlier, I would have been on my, would have been on my second or third marriage just because I'm so like crazy that, I need to be settled. I need now to be settled. And had I tried to settle too early, I think I would have tried to break out of the prison.
Okay. How do you define success beyond monetary wealth? Right, kids?
Making mass impact on a mass scale. So what I mean by making mass impact on a mass scale? Money. The first time you work for money. And it's not really about money because suppose if you look at my previous company, it was sold for $150 million. Everyone does it. So you make the money. It's not about, it's like, great. It's the first time you work for money. And then you've proven to yourself that you can make money. Okay. And that's always your first rodeo is about financial stability. That's your first. Once you've got the financial stability, like when you got $100 million and then you make another $100 million, the marginal utility of the next $100 million is zero because you can't spend it. You cannot spend that kind of money, right? So first time around, success is measured in whether you can achieve financial stability, financial freedom, not stability, financial freedom. Second time around is, for me, whether I can make mass impact on a mass scale. What is mass impact on a mass scale? A lot of wealthy people give money to charities. That's great. But it's
a good
example. Breast cancer charity in the USA, in Virginia.
Okay.
Mass impact, but not mass impact on a mass scale. Using a platform that has over 1 million subscribers to make over 1 million people financially free so that they can live a real life in their 18,800 days. Walking around anywhere you walk around the world from Mexico to Bali to South Africa to the USA and people acknowledging that you are the person who's helped them into financial freedom. And knowing that you've done this with very little reward. When I said very little reward, yes, of course we make money, but there's no direct reward. A viewer can watch the show and get all the learnings for absolute free. Like, there's no bill, there's no charge, there's no nothing, right? So for me, I think success is being able to make a mass impact on a mass scale. So I think Elon Musk is exceptionally successful because he's managed to make mass impact on a mass scale 25 times. People that can make mass impact on a mass scale globally, that for me is success. So yeah, that's how I measure success. How many people's lives can I change on a mass scale so that they can change the generation, at multiple generations? That's mass impact.
Do you think Banter could run without you?
For a short period of time, yes.
Without you meaning you're out now?
For a short period of time, yes. I think there's not enough new leaders in Vanta. I think business is very young, three years old. So it takes time to build management and leadership layers, but it is one of our weaknesses. We don't have enough long-term people in the business. But I mean, again, you don't expect that after a three-year business. I think any business where its founder leaves after 3 years.
Yeah.
So yes, it will be. It's not right now, but I'm not too stressed about it because it's a baby. Vanta's a baby.
What is one thing you wish Fefe knew about himself that you see?
No, I think Fefe's on the right road. What does Fefe need to know about himself?
I think Fefe does a lot of things for acknowledgement, and he needs to be acknowledged all the time. And when he's not, he starts to wonder whether we see what he's doing. We see what you're doing, bro. Just keep grounding.
What is your greatest fear apart from going back to being poor?
Obviously, my biggest fear is, it's weird because no matter how wealthy you become, or at least if you come from nothing, you know how shit coming from nothing is. It's the worst. It's fucking hell. When I lost the money in Luna last cycle, I was like, I didn't care about anything. I just cared about going back to where I came from. So I don't want to go there again. I don't want to go there again because I know how bad it is. My biggest fear, I guess, is my health and losing my energy. So like, I have a lot of energy, as you know. My biggest fear is losing my energy, or like, you know, like you forget that everything is cool until your body temperature goes up 1.5 degrees. That's it. Like everything is like amazing, and you can run and you can go to the gym and you can do 5 shows a day and you can stab 20 hours a day and you can drink and whatever else. And then your body temperature goes from 36.5 to 38, and then you are lying in bed and you're fucking man down, right? Like you cannot move. You've got bone aches and shit like that. Shows you how fragile we are. So what's my biggest fear? One is losing my health/energy. So I think the two are interrelated, but like not having the amount of energy that I have today, not being able to wake up in the morning, go to gym, come back, play football with my kids, you know, that's a big fear of mine. And I think it's inevitable at some point, but trying to prolong that as much as possible. I think my other fear is losing my parents. Like I'm exceptionally connected to my parents. And as they have become older, I've started to enjoy much more spending time with them, because you kind of realize that the days are numbered. It's not forever. And so like my biggest fear is like, you know, we work so hard and you know, do we spend enough time with our parents? That's another fear of mine. And then the last one is, it's probably twofold, but it's, do I spend enough time with my kids? Because in like my kids are like, my oldest is nearly 10 or 9, but you know, it's close to 10. I think like there's a point where they stop being kids and they start being, and like, did I actually spend enough time with them as kids? Because I work so hard and I travel so much and whatever else. My biggest fear is that I want to rewind because I did things wrong, and I don't want that. So as much as like, I'm, you know, like Banta's also a child of mine, and it keeps me busy. But I think my biggest fear is that I look back at my family time and say, you know, like you did an extra conference, you did an extra. So I try and spend as much time as I can with them whilst I'm juggling like big life, you know? So yeah, those I think are my.
How do you balance work-life balance? How do you?
Because you're whenever I see you, you're from the morning, like from whatever, you wake up, you start watching content, you jump on the management call, you jump on the research call, you jump on meetings, you start prepping your show, then you do the show, then you jump on spaces, and you get home, what, 6, 7?
Like, I would love to spend, I probably should spend more time with my kids, and I probably like, but I'll tell you what my routine is. So as a house, we wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning. The kids kind of only have to be ready to go to school at 7:10. So we kind of get like half an hour in the mornings where we all lie in bed and we just cuddle as a family. Like we're just all lying in bed. My son's all lying on top of me and my daughter. Then like as a ritual, like the morning ritual of dressing the kids and, you know, rushing them to go to school. It's good time spent. I always take my kids to school. If I'm in South Africa, I always take my kids to school. Like that's not negotiable. Like
that time in the car, even though it's 10 minutes, is like we sing, we talk, we laugh. Then I'll try and get home an hour or two before they go to bed, you know? And so, like, I'll get home and I'll put my phone in the charger face down, and then I'll just go and play football with them. Maybe we have dinner together, maybe not. Maybe we just play chess. I don't know. We do something. And then on the weekends, from Friday night, from Friday when I get home until Monday morning, like, don't phone me. I'm not going to come out. I'm not going to go out with my friends. Like, I spend every waking minute with my kids. Barring maybe I'll do a meme show Sunday night when, yeah, just want to get out of the house a little bit. But that's how I balance it.
When were you most scared in your life?
Scared when I was building my previous company. A lot of the time when I built the previous company, I was, you know, I was young and I was trying to build a big business. I was obsessed with building a big business. So from the age of 25 to 37, kind of probably lost those years. Why? Because I was running a business, and instead of enjoying the process of actually running a business, I was paralyzed with fear. How will I make the payroll this month? What if I lose my clients? So I think, like, think as an entrepreneur, you're walking on a tightrope and you're holding like a stick. And the one hand of the stick is constructive paranoia. And I think constructive paranoia is a very important quality. And then on the other side, you have paralyzing fear. So paralyzing fear is when you, like, you're so stressed that you can't sleep at night because you're not going to make payroll, right? Like, or you're so stressed. Problem is, I think a lot of the time I was really in between the two, where I didn't want, like, I landed a big client. I never wanted to lose the client. So I was paralyzed with fear because I didn't want to lose the client. So I think building my first big business was a very scary and overwhelming experience. And in hindsight, I should have enjoyed it more, and case sera. I've had one or two health scares in my life where I was scared, genuinely scared. And again, you realize, like, small things, big difference, bro. You know, like, small things, big difference. I'll give you one example, like, that of something that actually happened to me in full transparency. I was at Harvard. I was studying at Harvard for 3 weeks. I mean, I can't believe I'm saying this, but I'll tell you. Like, and there was blood in my semen. I mean, don't ask how I know, but I was away from my wife for 3 weeks, bro. Things happened. And there was blood in my semen. Like, you know, in your 40s, early 40s, you want to see blood in the semen, bro. And I came back to South Africa. Tried to go to the hospital in the US, but it was the US medical system, bro. You don't want to go through US medical system. So I got back to South Africa, had all the tests, and you have an MRI. And the doctors basically said, look, we suspect there's an 80% chance that you have cancer in your prostate. I had blood in my semen for X amount of weeks. They did an MRI. The MRI showed them something was wrong with my prostate. The shape was wrong or something. And so then they prepare you for the worst. Because at that point, when you've got an 80% chance of cancer, what they do is that the next part of it is they do a biopsy. And the biopsy is they stick needles. Somehow, I don't know, but I wasn't under anesthetic, but they stick needles into your prostate and they take out samples. And so what happens is you have blood in your semen, they do the MRI, they tell you, they can immediately see the shape, and they can immediately say, okay, look, there's an 80% chance. So they estimate, look, you have an 80% chance of that you've got cancer. And then they start preparing you for what cancer in the prostate actually means. So I'll tell you how they... First thing is that at this age, they only remove your prostate. So they remove your prostate. Okay, so what does that mean? It means you can't ejaculate anymore. It means that for, you know, maybe a year after the operation, you effectively can't hold your urine in very well until you can get the functionality back. You know, like, and so I lived for like probably 2 weeks and with this cloud over my head that I have prostate cancer. You know, and it's also, we had prostate cancer in the family. You know, some members of our family had very early age prostate cancer. So it wasn't. And so like for 2-3 weeks, I lived with this. Because what they do is once they do the biopsy, they don't give you the results immediately. They have to harvest the results in a layer. So you kind of live for 2-3 weeks with this cloud over your head that you potentially have cancer. And then, like, thank God I didn't. And they managed to treat it via antibiotics. But what I'm trying to say to you is that, like, I was genuinely scared. Because a part of you that's supposed to function one way just doesn't function anymore. And you're like, fuck, things are shutting down. Things are breaking down. You know, like, so like, you know, I'm very, very, very grateful for my health every single day. I test every 6 months for all my bloods, everything I test. Why? Because, yeah, you know, like at that moment, you realize that with one thing, your quality of life is grossly diminished. Like, imagine not being able to ejaculate anymore. That just sounds fucking weird. I mean, a lot of people do. They live after prostate cancer, and that's
really did that steer you in? Did you change anything in your life? Did you start eating healthier? Did you start doing different business? Did you?
No, I'll tell you why not. Because that kind of cancer is genetic and hereditary mainly, and it's not through food or
no. But from realization, it's like anything can go bad in 2 seconds. Do you like spend less time on your
office? I've always been. I mean, let's just talk about it. I don't drink, as you know. I don't drink. I don't smoke, right? I mean, I do sometimes have a gummy just for fun, and much less nowadays. But I have a gummy, and I mean, I don't really smoke joints. I used to smoke joints. I prefer just eating a gummy. It gives me much better high. So I don't really have a bad lifestyle. I'm at gym 6 days out of seven. I'm at gym anyway. So where are my vices? One is the phone. So if the phone is really bad for you via AirPods, I'm fucked. Okay, can I change my behavior on my phone? How can I possibly how can I possibly do things and be less on the phone? Less on the phone just means less productivity, which is not, you know, like that's the one thing. Less stress, more relaxation time. I could probably do that a bit better. Although I love what I'm doing. So a lot of the stress that I have is positive stress. You know, like there's stress, there's negative stress and positive stress. I have positive stress. So did I change anything? I think the one thing that changed was my appreciation for life. And also like, I pray every morning. Like I do a ritual. I'm Jewish and there's a ritual where you tie these leather straps to your body. It's called tefillin. And I do it every morning. Not because I'm religious. It's just because I have to remind myself that I'm grateful for health and being alive and being able to do what I do. And the best way to do it and to demonstrate that in front of the kids is to do a ritual of praying in the morning. So, you know, those are things that I do. That's what changed my appreciation for life. Yeah. And probably put it on turbo that I've got to enjoy every single fucking day. You know, like, and you know, like I will never say no to an experience. Yeah. No matter how tired I am, no matter, bro, you want to go overseas? Let's go.
And can I get a panini?
You know me, bro. It's like, you want to a panini? I said, I'll turn the world. I'll drive 100 kilometers to get to a panini.
Oh my God. Thanks for sharing, eh? What's your biggest regret in business?
Staying in a partnership that was toxic for 17 years. Business relationship. I should have broken out a long time ago.
Why did you stay?
Because we had a big baby. So it's like probably why parents stay together when they're married, right? Like we had a very big business. The business had, you know, 1,550 staff, was a very successful business, but the partnership was a terrible, toxic partnership. And then eventually at some point, I was like, okay, it's enough. Sell the business. It's enough.
What would you have done differently if you could now go back? Because if you separate, you probably don't build this business.
Done it without partners. You know, like, why did I get a partner in the first place? Because I didn't have my own self-confidence.
Right. Could you have done it or not?
I'd like to think I could have. I mean, I've done it now with Dancer. And it's much better and it's much more fun and it's much less toxic and it's much quicker. So what? I should have done it the first time around. Look, no regrets. I am where I am because of where I've been. And I have no regrets. But I'm saying you're asking what's...
If any.
Like, no real regrets.
What is your biggest regret in crypto?
50% plus of my portfolio in Luna.
Yeah.
But wait. Is it a regret?
You wouldn't be here, hey?
I wouldn't. But Banter wouldn't be a business if that didn't happen.
Why?
Because I was making so much money out of investments that I actually didn't give a shit about the business. Like, I was making so much money out of Luna that all I needed to do was wake up in the morning and look at my portfolio and I was fucking richer every single day. So I didn't pay any attention to the business. Banter wasn't a business. It was just a fucking streaming channel. And then I woke up one that after and I thought, the only way that I can make more money than I have with Luna is and keep it under my control if I build the fucking business. And so, yeah, it's a regret. Probably should have diversified my portfolio, but who knows? Maybe if it didn't happen, then I wouldn't be here today, right? So
this so sad. Like, if I didn't lose all the money I lost from 2021, I wouldn't be sitting here at all.
So then, yeah, is it a regret? No regrets, sir. No,
that's actually good. Tell me your recovery steps after Luna crash. You've talked about it a lot, but like, how can someone overcome a crash like that?
So for those people that are home, yeah, most people don't know, you know, in the 2021 cycle, I got a little bit carried away, and in the portfolios that I manage, we had over 50% of our portfolio in Luna. And then, as you know, Luna went to zero.
It was a crypto project that went to basically zero, the whole ecosystem.
And I lost over 50% of my wealth, like 50% of my crypto portfolio. It was terrible.
Just for anybody who doesn't know, it's $100 million plus.
Plus, yeah, $100 million plus. So what is the question?
What is your biggest regret with this? How do you recover, sir? How do you recover? What are the steps you took to recover? You went over there, eh? So you went back to that place.
Yeah. So first of all, I threw a pity party, and I felt really sorry for myself. And I was like, I'll never get up again. And then, for the first couple of days, I'm like, I fucked this whole thing up. I'm so angry. How stupid am I? I'm the most stupid person in the world. I'll never show my face ever again. I hate this. And then what got me through it was consistency. I was like, you better show up every day, bro. And even in the days, you know, like the days where you really, really don't want to do a show. I don't want to come to the office. I mean, the whole market was crashing. I put everybody everywhere into Luna. Come to the office. I don't want to go to the office. But it was like, you know me, I'm consistent. That's the one superpower that I have. It's my biggest superpower. I just carried on doing a show every single day. In hindsight, the shows were the best thing I ever did, because as I was speaking to 100,000 psychologists, I just spilled everything out. Until eventually there was nothing left to spill. And then it was like, okay, what are we going to do now, guys? And then I had the pressure from the community, and I had the pressure from the office. And I was like, do we tap out and exit crypto? Do we tap out and stop taking risks? Or do we say, fuck this shit. I know what that feels like. I managed to get there before. If I could get there before, I'm going to fucking do it again, or I'm going to die trying. And it was like, you know, like the mission was get higher than you were before. That was like the only mission. Get higher than you were before. Now, I know right now that seems, because now we're back in the bull market, and that seems, I'm trying to cast your mind back to what that meant. The market, when that happened, the market was on a non-stop downward trend. There was no recovery. It was Luna went to zero, Bitcoin went from 70 back down to 30, 20, you know, there was no recovery. The thought of actually rebuilding to be bigger than you were back then was actually, it was one of those goals that you set knowing you'll never reach it. But you set it because that gives you like a place to go.
Did you think you'll never reach it? Or did you believe that you can get bigger?
I doubted. But in my heart of hearts, I said, look, I'm going to either reach it or I'm going to die trying.
Yeah.
But I did doubt. Like, it's like, bro, you were in a token that went from 7 cents to $130 in size. How many times in your life is that going to happen? How many times in your life are you going to buy at 7 and possibly be able to exit at $130? It's maybe 200x on size. On size, bro. Come on.
Crazy.
So, but I mean, look, the good news is we're back in the bull market. I would say this is probably the beginning of the altcoin season. We're already much higher than we were. Much higher.
You know what is actually interesting for anybody who's watching as well? We're going to link in the description. I went back and I watched your shows the next week. This whole thing went down. And on that show, 3 days later, probably, you're saying the same thing on the show.
Yeah.
You're like, we're here and we're going to make it all fucking back.
Yeah. But that's also, look, it's also the pressure of leadership.
Yeah.
So like on the one hand, I'm very grateful for the fact I had a community and I had to lead. Because if I didn't lead, then they were all going to go down. And the same thing with the office, I had to lead. So sometimes even though I didn't want to do shit, I had to lead, bro. I had to lead. I had to wake up in the morning and lead.
Did you feel that your leadership was shaken in the office when this whole thing went down?
In the first 3 or 4 days, yes. And I actually thought a lot of people would leave. I really thought a lot of people would leave. And I think a lot of people came very close to leaving. And then when I turned, everybody just followed. Because you know what the difference is? The worse things get, the more people need a leader. The better things get, the less people want leadership. Because
But when times are bad, people want someone to follow to get them out of the time. Just think about World War II. Think about Hitler, the rise of Hitler. Like, things were so bad in Germany, they just needed to reach out to someone or to follow someone. So the strongest leaders are made in the worst situations in the world, right? So, like, in crypto, that was one of the worst situations. And again, I thought everyone would leave. And I would have also left. Like, the boss has lost half his fortune. Crypto's no one's going to watch crypto content anymore. Everybody was fucking wrecked. Everyone in the office lost money. Everybody hated crypto. Easy, just leave. Tap out. And I was scared that everyone would tap out. Actually, I wasn't scared. I didn't give a shit. Because I was like, I was dead. I was dead inside. You know, like, think about it like this. When someone steals your house, steals your car, beats you up, and they just want to kick you one last time.
Yeah.
Whatever, just hit it. Like, I don't really care.
Did anyone leave?
Probably not. Can't remember, but probably not.
What was the biggest failure of your life and why? I think, is that it?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, you could say.
Share another story.
Failure story?
Yeah. Where you failed, but stood up.
Everybody knows Luna.
Trying to think. There must be another one. I mean, there's hundreds of them. I'm just trying to think about... You know, I fail a lot every day. Even a bad show for me is a failure, but... Full joke. We used to own a marketing company, and the business model of the marketing company was you lose money for 10 months of the year, but you make a lot of money in November, December, because it's the festive season. In the festive season, the business is probably 10 years old. It's just established. And I get a, I'm talking to you like, you're talking about like 80% of your work is done 20% of the year. It's the busiest time of my life. It's 5 days before the December vacation. My receptionist calls me. She says, "Right, you need to come down to meet someone." I'm like, I looked at my diary, like, I've read meetings every 15 minutes. I don't have a second. And this person's not in my diary. Put the phone up. She phones again. She says, you need to come down here. I'm like, why? She says, there's a liquidator here and he's here to liquidate the business. Huh? What? We're rich. We have money in the bank. The company's growing. Some idiot sued us for the equivalent of $3,000. When we bought our company, we bought a shelf company. It's like a dormant company, which basically there's companies that sell dormant companies. So you don't have to wait. So we bought this dormant company, but we never changed the address. So this person sued us for bullshit suing. And we never got the notice because it went to this warehouse of companies. And it was actually called the Shelf Company Warehouse. And then, funny enough, so we never got the notice. And then there's a law in South Africa, there was a law that you had to publish it in the local newspaper. So who reads the fucking newspaper? And it's also like in civil writing in the newspaper, there's like one column of like lawsuits. We said, didn't read that. And then because we never went to court, the judge basically ruled that we lost the money. And then in the sentencing, well, not anything, but like the award or the penalty is that, well, you have to liquidate this business. And then 5 days to go. 5 days to...
But why did you have to liquidate it? It's only $3,000.
Because they don't know that there's only $3,000. So they just give it an order and they give it to liquidate and they say, well... So the first thing that happens when he walks in is he takes over the business and he freezes the bank.
Okay, now is this really happening?
Yeah, like in the accounts are closed. Your accounts are frozen, sir.
Do you know it's $3,000 only?
Yeah. But the thing is, now you can't pay now because you had an opportunity to pay and you never paid. So now you have to go to court and the court has to reverse the judgment so that you can pay. And so 5 days until the court closes, because the court's closing for recess and we're out of money. Well, we have money, but the bank account's frozen. So long story short, we hire a lawyer. We're all panicking because, like, I've mortgaged my parents' house. I've mortgaged my car. I've borrowed money from friends, but there's a good chance that they're going to liquidate this business. And it's going to go into like a final liquidation and it's finished. And then somehow we managed to rescue the business. We paid this person 10 times what they sued us for. 10 times. The $3,000 they ended up costing us $30,000. But it was still safer than going to the judge, and the judge could have kicked the can down the road and said, okay, this is not urgent, come back in January. And they had no business because we were just burning money every day. We had no money to burn. So, you know, some mistakes that I've made. My admin is not very good. And so I should have changed the address.
Okay. What was the most important lesson you learned growing up? I see Red likes this.
I think Remy likes this. I mean, I don't usually get interviewed. I'm usually on the other side of the camera. So I grew up with relatively nothing. So when I say relatively nothing, we came from a relatively poor family. When I say relatively poor, we always had food. We always had school. But we never had any luxuries. We weren't allowed to have any luxuries. So, like, no, like, we were the poorest kid. I was always the poorest kid in school.
Is it low middle class, is it?
It was probably, yeah, middle class. It was middle class. But we always tried to go into higher. So, like, private schools versus the government schools. But that meant a big strain on the family. You know, like, one working parent in a job, not in a, he wasn't an owner or an entrepreneur. It was in a job. And I was always the left out kid. I was always, like, I'll give you an example. There was one year in my school where the whole standard, the whole grade goes away for 3 months on this, like, learning vacation. And they go overseas for 3 months. But in order to do that, you had to pay, like, the equivalent of what is today, like, $3,000-$4,000 for the trip. Now, we couldn't afford that. So there was, like, six people out of 300 that couldn't afford it. So I was, like, left behind. And then, like, when I turned 18, when most people in my school turned 18, all their cars. Like, when I turned 18, there was no car. Okay, you want a car, buy it. You know? So I was always left wanting, and I always felt like I was getting screwed. I always felt left out. I could never wear branded clothes. I could never, all the guys wearing Levi's and Diesel, and we couldn't wear that. So that would have meant, like, you know, my dad was renting from the 5,000 a month, and that was 300. Like, that's, you can't do that. You can't do that to the family. So I guess the lesson that I learned subconsciously was I would rather grow up poor and hungry than wealthy and not hungry. Because if you look at where the other guys were, all these guys that got cars and all these guys that got the jeans and all these guys that got the clothes and everything else, like, they have no fight in them. What that school did, being put as the bottom of the class all the time, both in education and in money and in being at the bottom, created this fight in me to make right the wrongs of the past. That is, like, I don't know, subconsciously, I think that I sometimes look at all those kids that I saw as above me, and I'm just like, I wave to them on the way up. And it's like, you know, like, almost like the way he says, like, fuck you, this is in my hands. And I'm trying to show you that when I have control of the situation, I can do whatever I want.
How did you not learn from this? You don't have expensive cars. You don't wear expensive watches, whatever. How did this not turn you into, okay, I'm going to buy myself whenever you could afford to actually because you're very modest. You're not.
Because I know what the value of money is, and because I know what it was like not to have money. And so I have an appreciation for everything. Like the thing.
No, but you can easily afford this. There's not like.
No, but you're not. I know, but it's a psychological thing. It's a psychological thing. Look, number one, I wouldn't be happier if I had. I mean, I saw a mutual friend of ours posting a thing with two watches. I mean, I don't know. Like, do you need to wear two watches? Mm-hmm. Even one. The time's here on your phone. And to be honest, the only reason why I wear this watch is because I'm scared I'll lose it if I don't wear it. Because I don't have a safe. So that, I'm scared I'll lose it. So those things don't make me happy. Also, you know, that car.
You never had the feeling of, like, now I can afford it and I'm going to go and just buy all the branded cars.
Let me give you an example, right? I know I can afford any clothing that I want, but I still can't walk into Prada. I just can't. Why? Because I can't pay $1,000 for a t-shirt. I just can't. Is it going to make a difference in my life? No. But I can't. You know, that's the biggest splash that I've managed to get myself to do is to fly first class and business class. Because that's that. The amount of money you're spending for 8 hours of being on a plane is not worth it. But I got to a point where, like, I travel so much and I hate the traveling so much. Fly and own an amazing airline and be in amazing hotels. And at least that makes your travel. Now, like, I don't need to spend $1,000 on a hotel, but nowadays I kind of do it. Why? Just because, fuck it, I can. But that's the most flex. I don't like materialistic things. You've seen my car.
Burr.
He's laughing because there's dog here, because I drive on the pavement. I don't want a better car. Like, you know what my biggest, like, one of my anxieties is? I don't make that car anymore. So I can't replace it with the same car.
It's like, it's so weird. But I see what you're saying. It's just so weird. It's just so weird to see it.
I want the same car. It's got like 40,000 kilometers now. Like in like 20, 30,000 kilometers, I probably have to change it. And I want the same car.
When you were up and coming in the marketing business, you started to make money, you know, you never felt as outsider. Because all the people you start meeting, or most of the people you start meeting, wear the expensive clothes, drive the expensive cars. You never felt that you had to buy stuff or wear stuff.
I mean, no. I hate people that do it.
Did you? You know, you feel, but you just disregarded the feeling, or you never felt it.
I still have a value for money, and that's why I say, like, I can afford any shirt and any pair of shoes, but I still can't buy a pair of shoes over a certain amount of money. I can't walk into Dolce & Gabbana and buy a pair of shoes. Just can't. I feel guilty. Feel ridiculous for doing it. I mean, maybe it's like a psychological thing, but I don't desire for materialistic things. You know that I could have whatever I want and I don't do it.
What legacy do you want to leave behind?
Mass impact, mass scale.
What was the best moment of your life?
I'm trying to just remember if it was child 1, 2, 3, or 4. Like, yeah,
all four.
One of the kids. Yeah, it's kids. It's the best moments are kids.
Was there ever a time when you doubted yourself or your abilities? How did you get through it?
Every single fucking day.
Still?
Yeah, sure.
You doubt yourself?
Every day. But I just keep on keeping up. Because
how do you doubt yourself? Like in what?
Am I doing the right thing? Can I do this? Should we do this? And then I just figure... que sera, sera, bro. Whatever will be, will be. Be smart, make calculated decisions, have fun, and whatever happens, happens. And if the plane crashes, it's nothing at all. Fine.
What's the biggest risk you've ever taken, and how did it turn out?
I'm guessing getting married is a big risk.
Is it?
Yeah, I think it's a massive risk.
Is that one of the biggest risks you've ever taken?
Yeah, it's the biggest risk you've ever taken.
Why?
Because I suppose. Getting married is one risk that you take because that sets really... Like all other things in life are reversible, right? Like which are a big risk? Most other things in life are reversible. So like you start studying the wrong thing. Okay, change course along the way. You get into the wrong business. Okay, then like it goes down, get into the next business. When you get married, well, it's actually not married. Marriage is the first step. So when you get married, from that point on, it's not one, it's two. And that's a massive, massive, massive risk because... It's not one or two. But then when you have the first child, it's three. And when you get to three, there's no backing out. So like marriage, you can still back out if you want to. When from the moment that your wife is pregnant first time and you conceive the first baby, that's the biggest risk that you take. Because if it's the first time in your life where you're paired with unchosen family. With unchosen, chosen, but not by birth. Right? You grew up with your brothers and your sisters. And your parents, that was forced upon you. That was not in your hands. And so that's like, there's nothing you can do about it. Marriage is the first decision that you make where you take on your own family. Probably the biggest risk that you take. Why? Because you marry the wrong person. And if you land up marrying the wrong person and you have kids with the wrong person, then, and I don't know, things go wrong or whatever, then effectively your whole life is now thrown apart. So I think the biggest risk that you take is really land up married. Everything else is reversible. Businesses, you can sell to your partners, you can unwind, you can finish it in court, etc. And all you're giving up is you're giving something financial, which you can rebuild again in 10 seconds. Kids is different because once your kids are conceived, there's no exiting that point.
Do you think your wife contributes to your success?
100.
Hi, sir.
Because she allows me the freedom. I say allows, not allows in terms of a slip, but she, because of what she does, I can do what I do. And I can travel as much as I travel. And I can, and then I could have led it up with a wife that was neurotic and wouldn't let me travel or try to limit my travel. And, you know, like, yeah. Also, my wife is the opposite of me. So, like, I'm crazy, ADD, running around, and she's like, switch the phone off, no Wi-Fi when we're sleeping, organic food, you know, let's buy a farm. Very different.
Okay. Let me see this before I have this.
Oh, God, here we go.
No, it's fine.
This is like the lesbians.
Yeah, I know. What is your relationship with ayahuasca?
Wow, ayahuasca has been probably the best thing I've ever done. It's Mother Nature. She's my healer. She's my medicine. She grounds me. She tells me the truth. She shows me that I'm being a dick. Yeah, she's the source of truth. You know, I've convinced you to do it as well.
Yeah.
Life-changing, fucking life-changing, fucking life-changing. I highly recommend it to everyone. And that's the point where this video was removed from YouTube.
Do you think it's...
I don't know.
Okay, so it says, tell me the top three most memorable stories from your childhood.
From my childhood?
Yeah. Or you can just share three stories. if we remove this anyway, just...
I'll tell you a story. So I told you when I was 35, I was single for the first time in a long time, and I was rich, well, half rich, and half good looking. And I'd been in relationships for many, many, many years, and I just figured, like, I've got to be out of relationships because at the prime of my life, as I told you, the time I bought a helicopter. And, you know, for like 5 years, my objectives were just validate the fact that you're a sex god as much as possible. And so what does that mean? It means that, you know, I mean, again, I don't recommend anyone do this, but it's at the time it was like, just, I'd been in relationships for so long and I just didn't know if I could be, you know, I was in like 7 year relationships, 5 year relationships. There was a period in my life where I was like, I just need to prove to myself that I'm a sex god. Okay.
I missed on the story.
One of the things that I did was I bought a helicopter, and that was like just coincidental. I just wanted to have fun in a helicopter.
You just walked by the street and you saw it.
Yes, I bought a house at a lake. It's a lake house, basically. It's on a golf estate.
This is the Wolf of Wall Street kind of stuff that we're talking about.
So, you know, the routine was I would fly the helicopter with girls to the house, and they would have parties at the house all weekend, and then we'd fly back on Monday morning and we'll go to work. And it's like, that was the routine. So the helicopter could take 4 people. And so a friend of mine and I decided we're going to take 2 girls to this lake house. So I said, okay, cool. I'll take them in the helicopter. You'll come with the shopping. later. And you'll bring like water, charcoal. We can buy meat, stuff like that. We can barbecue. So we leave. We've flown. We landed at the lake house. Now, remember, we don't have a car. And the nearest store, there's no Uber. You don't have a car. And the nearest store is, I don't know, 20 minutes away. And he phones. He says, look, I'm not coming. Okay, but dude, I'm at the lake house with the only mode of transport that I've got is a helicopter. Okay? And we don't have food. We don't have water. We don't have charcoal. We don't have anything. And it's not like I can phone a cab. I'm like, it's a house on a lake. So I'm like, what the fuck do we do? Like, I know it sounds funny now, but you eat. What do we drink? So I was like, shit. Okay, well, the only mode of transport that we have is a helicopter. Switch on a helicopter, and we fly until I saw in the shopping mall with like a grocery store. And I kid you not, I landed this fucking helicopter in the parking lot of the grocery store. Like, imagine, like, shopping at Walmart or whatever it is, and just this maniac trying to land a helicopter. Anyway, I landed the helicopter like nothing ever happened. We got out, we took the shopping trolley, we filled it up with meat and whatever else, and we got back in the helicopter. And we took off. And like, there's thousands of people just watching us. But I mean, like to us, it was like the only way that we could get food. So because we had all the shopping bags, instead of parking the helicopter at the end of the jetty where the boat, like at the end, I parked the helicopter very close to the house on the golf course. Because there was a house with like multiple other houses on a golf course. So I parked the helicopter on the golf course because that was the nearest place to the house to carry all the helicopter parking was like very far away. So I parked the helicopter there, maybe subconsciously noticing it was a golf course, but not actually thinking about it too much. And so, okay, now we have food and whatever. We have a barbecue and then we have a big party that night. I'm talking like a massive, massive, massive party. Okay, like you guys can imagine what we got there. So it's just me and 2 girls. And it's 5:30 in the morning. Okay, I'm talking to you like, I'm so fucked. I'm like shivering, okay? At 5:30 in the morning, the security guard rings the doorbell. And I'm in no condition to even get out of bed, let alone to drive or to fly a helicopter. And he's like, knock, knock, knock. I'm like, what's up? He says, you're parked in the fairway. The guys want to tee off. Okay, look, moving a helicopter is not like moving a car. It's not like you start the car. And it's like, I'm not even in any condition to stand, let alone to fly anything. But I go outside and the helicopter's in the middle of the fairway. And the guys were warming up and they got that, right? Huh? So I think it's also fuck with that, but no condition to fly, but
well, did he tell you to just wolf for the helicopter?
Yeah, he's like, move the helicopter. The guys want to tee off. And like, you're in the middle of the fairway. The guys can't tee off. It's like hole number one.
Shit.
So now I have to fly this thing. God, I'm in no condition to fly. I did it. I managed to somehow, I managed to, in between my shivering, and I managed to like navigate this helicopter and land it.
You got in trouble from it?
No.
In the security?
I mean, I risked my life and I risked his life because I took him with me in a helicopter. I was like, if you want me to move the helicopter, come in. He's like, what? I'm not jumping.
But was he happy though?
I mean, you're scared. He was holding off the window like this. I won't forget. But I'm like, that was a good story. I think that was a funny story that I kind of want to delete from my database.
So I thought I said we're going to delete from the video. Well, we'll see. Maybe, right? Thanks.
Thank you, sir. But it's nice being on the other side of the...
Well, it's coming.